It's Dear Instructional Designer, episode 57. Hey everybody, and welcome back to Dear Instructional Designer, the show about the instructional design journey. I'm your host, Kristen Anthony. It's season 4 of Dear ID, where we are concentrating on the journey into freelancing as an instructional designer. This episode, I am talking with J.R. Dingwall, a higher ed instructional design consultant who I first met through Jennifer Madrill and Designers for Learning. J.R., you want to say hi?
Hey.
I chatted with JR over email, and I'm super excited to have him on the show because he has a really important story that I want to make sure we cover this season. JR went freelance for a while and then decided that it wasn't for him. And as someone who is always sort of on the crossroads of this myself, I'm really interested in how this worked for him. Let's get started. JR, let's begin by talking about your journey into freelancedom. How did you decide to jump out into the ether and become a freelance instructional designer?
I started instructional design after grad school. I've got both my Bachelor of Education and a Master's of Education, so maybe a more traditional route into ID rather than the accidental ID route. I worked in a university for a couple of years and then switched institutions. And even though you work in different units, a lot of higher ed instructional design has lots of similar elements when you're within a university. So at that time, I was kind of looking at some different reports that were coming out about instructional design. I participate in some of the LinkedIn communities and other online communities, and just seeing what was on the other side is different tool sets and different contexts and a different breadth of scope and content. And that kind of interested me very much. I have this generalist sort of approach to life where a workshop in like glassmaking will come up and it's like, oh, that looks interesting. And so, you know, go down the rabbit hole for a little bit. And then, oh, a workshop in screen printing comes up. And so go do that. And I think that applies to my professional activities as well, as just kind of seeing what the different possibilities are. At the time, I was working in kind of continuing ed in the university and built my portfolio, rebranded and retooled my CV and resume, seen some stuff from graphic designers, like different resumes you want to steal. So I was like, oh, great, like a different approach to this. So that itself was a bit of an exercise. Started looking around for different, just small side opportunities. So looking at different places like Upwork and Workopolis, or different university postings just for contract work. And then finally, after kind of checking out a few of those, starting some initial conversations, there was one project in particular that came up to develop an open curriculum. And instead of a side thing, it turned out that that was a whole bunch of work in a short period of time. So I decided to leave a full-time position for this contract, which I knew had an end date, but I just couldn't pass up the opportunity. So then I kind of left the institution and went out on my own at that point.
Was that scary for you? I know when I first started thinking about freelance, I was sort of freaked out about it.
I couldn't tell if it was fear or excitement, or maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah, it's fear excitement.
Yeah, fear excitement is definitely it. It was a pretty big OER project, and I had been kind of watching things go on in the OER and open education movement for a couple of years. So I think it was maybe more excitement than fear, because I didn't really think about the ramifications of leaving a full-time permanent position for something that was more temporary, just because the project itself was something I really wanted to dig into.
People who want to be freelancers, I think a lot of us just sort of get that one opportunity and we're like, okay, we're going to go for it. I'm wondering, how did you price yourself?
For that particular contract that I made the first jump, thankfully, in their posting, they kind of had a range. So a little bit of that was that then it became negotiation, because they had an hourly rate set, which was pretty close to what I had calculated my full-time rate to be. When it came to then also talking to other prospective projects, that's when it became a bit tougher for me to figure out. It's like, okay, wait, I need software, or do I need hosting space? Do I need like a web space to to have to develop things and then to be able to share back and forth. What do I do with printing if they need like that kind of stuff? And so that coming from kind of full-time opportunities was really difficult to try and think about, because you can't at that point just do the standard conversion of like, well, I work this many hours per year in my previous job at a salary, so that works out to about this many dollars per hour, because there are all of those other elements. So I kind of went with a 1.5 times thing just as a starting place to see what the reactions would be. And some of them were positive. But what I noticed with a lot of the contract work is that on some of those websites, the rate was extremely low. Then I had to try and figure out, it's like, well, is this person maybe open to a conversation about that? Or do I just ignore it and move on?
We have talked about this a little bit on the show this season previously, is that whole issue of hourly rate versus sort of a fixed rate. And that ties into one of the things that you mentioned when we were talking before, and that was the ability to estimate projects. And I'm wondering, is that a skill that you learned as a freelancer? Is that something that you took with you into freelancing from the work that you'd done previously?
It was something that I kind of ran up to first in my full-time positions in higher ed, program managers or subject matter experts, because we would hire subject matter experts to do course development. And so I'd work with them. And so from the manager standpoint, they would ask me, it's like, well, how long would it take to just do the PowerPoints for the course, or to revise like 25% of this examination? And then on the other side, the SMEs are asking, well, how many hours do you expect me to put in on this whole course? And that's kind of like asking how long a piece of string is going to be. So I started reading different literature, blogs from different instructional designers that were more on the freelance and corporate side rather than the academic instructional designers. I checked out SlideShare, and I came across a few different kind of estimating tools, one of which was a survey done by Chapman Alliance. And they surveyed like 3,000 instructional designers or something like that, and then kind of broke it into instructor-led training, basic e-learning, and then kind of higher levels of fidelity for e-learning. And so that just gave me kind of a starting place to say, it's like, okay, like this style of project might take this many hours of development between me and a subject matter expert and a developer per hour of instruction. And then does that match my own personal experience? Yes or no? And then try to adjust it from there. But it totally depends on the experience of the subject matter expert as well, or the context of the organization. So it's like there are all of these different elements that started making it quite difficult to make those estimates.
How did you handle the differences in approach to development, turnaround time, and tool sets when you decided to freelance? Because one of the things that I've noticed is that for higher ed, my turnaround time is almost always like 3 months. And then for corporate, like I was turning around some things, obviously much smaller, in like a week.
That's kind of what I've noticed as well. So I think generally in higher ed, my ideal development cycle is kind of like start the conversation about 8 months before the course goes live. And then 6 months is like kind of cushy. And then 4 months is like when I'm sounding alarm bells and saying, it's like, this one's going to be tough. But most of them tend to fall into that 4 to 5 month period. As soon as I was looking at some of the other opportunities, the scope was a lot smaller. So then I think it was the scope that made the turnaround times quite a bit quicker, or the way that the project was broken up. So for example, that open curriculum, we knew we had about 6 to 8 months in total. But then because of the volume of work that we were producing, then it became like, yeah, get this thing turned around. My subject matter expert will hand it off to me, and I need to have that like kind of reviewed by the next day. We had one person working across the ocean. And so just because of the time difference, then it's, you know, if I want to make sure that they have something to work on, then I need to make sure I get this turned around, or else they're going to be sitting around all day tomorrow. In terms of the different tools that we used, I started to try to use the same sorts of tools kind of across any project that I use. Google Docs is a really handy one, just because the dreaded versionitis when you start dealing with different course content, Google Docs. So that's made it actually really useful, the way that it tracks version history and everything. When I was more on the kind of like freelancing side of things. I tried a number of different project management tools like Wunderlist, which, you know, when you click off a task and it makes that wonderful dinging sound, it feels pretty good. And you can share those. But most of the project management tools I've found, it's all about the habits of who you're working with. And so even if you really like a tool, it totally can vary depending on your subject matter expert or who your program manager is or who the contact within the organization is. I've tried Slack on a number of different projects, and it drives me crazy every time I do that because it doesn't thread the way that emails do. And I like the threading and being able to separate specific trains of thought. And so I haven't figured out a way to use that really effectively yet. I know there are different organizations that use it and they must use it well, but I have yet to see that. Hourskeeper is an app that actually one of my subject matter experts recommended to me just for tracking projects and time on task and what kinds of tasks and for invoicing. So I just sit there and can punch in and out with my iPhone because I was still operating on that hourly rate. And then basic tools like Skype and Hangouts.
You worked on an OER project, which is actually really interesting. So I'm assuming like you didn't use the big tools that weren't open, obviously, and couldn't be edited by other people. So like in terms of development, kinds of tools did you use to sort of make products?
We might get some criticism from people that are really, really invested in only open stuff. We did all of our writing in Google Docs, actually. And that was something that we decided early on, and mostly for development purposes. So we had four people working on this project across different time zones, across the country, and like I said, across the ocean. So it was an easy way for us all to be looking at the same thing at the same time, being able to edit in different places, because one of the deliverables was a textbook. And so one of the sections of this textbook could be 80 pages. So you don't want to be sitting around and waiting for somebody or merging versions and trying to figure out how to manage that. And all along the way, we were thinking, it's like, well, you know, at some point, this will get out of Google Docs and, you know, we'll share it in some other thing like WordPress. Or towards the end, we kind of looked at Pressbooks and we ended up just leaving it in Google. So we made a copy and switched everything to view access. And I think Suggestions is available. So sometimes I still get weird emails depending on the permissions on specific documents about, you know, so-and-so wants access to this or so-and-so is trying to edit this. But then we tied it to a WordPress page. And with the view access, Google Docs actually has the ability to let the user download as a PDF, as a Word document, as an EPUB. And so when it came to the end of that project, we thought, well, there are your different export formats. And although it lives in Google, it's still publicly accessible and they can get their own copy of it. And if they want to adapt it, then that's fine. So we've retained our own versions of those documents just in case, for whatever reason, Google would decide to flip the switch on Docs. But that ended up being the primary tool that we used. Some of the slide decks and things, we use Google Slides, but I think for us, it was more about access and cost to students at the end of the day, rather than that fundamental open source kind of methodology behind it.
Are there alternatives to Google Docs that are open source?
Yeah, I think it was towards the end of 2015 when I was first introduced to Pressbooks, and that's something that I use a lot now. And what's nice about that one is if you're used to any kind of online authoring, like it's built on top of WordPress. So, you know, I go in and I say, make a chapter. All of like the editors look kind of the same. And then when you publish it to the web, what I really like about it is it looks like an online book. It has like the left and right tab. So go to next chapter or go to the table of contents and you can kind of get anywhere in the book. So I think the hierarchy, it builds a chapter as a page in WordPress, like that kind of hierarchy. So it works out really well that way. And then they have an export feature where the author can export it. And so when you visit the web version of the book, you can download the PDF and EPUB. You can even download the XML file and fork it over to your own instance of Pressbooks. And that was really appealing at the time. It just, within the confines of our project, it didn't work out for timing. now with a lot of different projects, I end up using either WordPress or Pressbooks, and that seems to be pretty mobile and usable.
Are you able to sort of do that collaborative work inside of it?
Yeah, like just like WordPress, you can assign different authors and or editors, and so they get different permissions within the book. Editors can't, for example, like put new plugins or themes into the book, but they can change any of the content within it. Where the challenge is that you can't do simultaneous editing. So we would have had to break out our particular project into kind of subchapters if we wanted to be able to have more people in the same kind of section of the book at the same time. I haven't seen anything that's like an open source version of Google Docs where you and I could be changing the same sentence at the same time sort of thing.
So what sorts of skills do you think are necessary to successfully run your own business that are on top of or outside of what an ID that has a full-time job at an organization might have?
Aside from those, you know, knowledge of adult learning theory, and I see a lot of postings with, you know, HTML, CSS, PHP, JavaScript, storyline, like the laundry list goes on. I think what I found is super useful or necessary for both. It doesn't matter, I think, what organization you work in, or if it's full-time or for a contract, but being able to scope a project or scope an amount of work and do charter development around that. Things like getting trapped by endless amounts of revisions is really terrifying, or getting partway into a project and saying, I thought it would take 20 hours or the half week or however long you thought it was at first. And as you pull up the carpet, you realize that the floorboards are rotten. There's one project I can think of in particular where it was just supposed to be swapping out a couple of the resources, and we ended up having to dissolve about 25% of the content, rewrite all of that, and then completely redo the assessment for the course. So it ended up taking about 5 times longer than I estimated at first, just because you don't know until what the state is until you start renovating. And in the charter development, then you can kind of build those things in. So I've started with a few projects now having the opportunity to say, well, the initial time is about 5 hours. And in that, we're going to go through and kind of do a full assessment. And so that's just part of it. And then at the end of that, there's a better time estimate. And then they can decide which elements they actually want to address. And the classic communication and time management is always useful. And then expectations management is a big one, being able to clearly articulate kind of what the process would be and how communication happens, and being able to communicate what the process should be if things start going sideways.
At least in my experience, you know, so many people, they want to give you the content and they want you to put it in the X by X slide and, you know, give it back. How did you, you know, as a freelancer deal with that, or did you experience that?
I definitely crossed a lot of that just in the postings, like being able to lurk and see, we want to onlineify this PowerPoint kind of stuff. And honestly, my approach at the time was just completely avoid it. My experience at the time was, if that's kind of the lead into the work, that the likeliness of being open to something else is maybe not there. But I was also, when I saw most of those, I was in a comfortable position of still being in the full time and just and kind of looking. So it wasn't like I was hungry for work necessarily. If I had been out of the full time position when I was seeing those, it might have been a different story. I might have just taken it on and said, you know what, this is what you asked for and we agreed to it, and I'll just kind of wash my hands of it at the end. But in cases where I can't avoid it, then I kind of look at the longer time frame that for the project. So I can think of a couple of examples where maybe just recording of lectures is maybe the style. And so saying, you know what, that's going to be the style. I understand that. Here are some enhancements we can do along the way. And so I look for not necessarily to change that approach specifically, but to figure out what supplementary things could maybe be added to it, what styles of activities could be added to that and built into the flow that would then enhance that approach. And some SMEs tend to be a little bit more receptive to that because you're not really fundamentally changing what they want to do, but you're saying, well, like, that'll work and this will help make it better. This will work for your learners. They'll have an opportunity to practice and then you can see that practice, for example. So just trying to find those opportunities between the cracks, as it were.
That makes a lot of sense. Going for those small wins so that over time you build up the trust and maybe next project, they'll let you try your hand at something a little bit bigger.
Yeah, even a week later, sometimes they'll come back like a week or two later on it. Again, you know, I'm thinking about a 6-month timeline and as opposed to a 2-week timeline, but they'll come back a little bit later and say, you know, I thought about that and that was actually a really good idea. And then that gets woven into the whole design.
So, JR, now after returning to higher education, after trying your hand at freelancing, what key takeaways or advice would you give others who are considering that pathway? Did you have a little bit of culture shock?
So there's definitely some culture shock. Anytime you move around, either within an institution or an organization or from one to another. And so with freelancing, I think the culture shock came from even just starting 5 conversations on a few different projects and then how each of those people kind of communicates with you. Is so vastly different than when you're working in one central location. So I think from a full-time working in higher ed and then looking at some of the freelancing opportunities, I think some of the biggest shocks for me were creeping expectations. So it's kind of like you'll start thinking about onlineifying a PowerPoint and then it's like, oh no, there's all of these other things all of a sudden. And one thing I really noticed was that a lot of the opportunities looked like they wanted a subject matter expert, instructional designer, and developer all in one person and for super cheap. And so that I found really challenging and trying to open up the communication to say, well, as an instructional designer, typically I'll work with a subject matter expert because I can't be an expert in everything, but as an expert in learning, I can help them develop something that'll work for your learners. And sometimes the conversation ends after that. And then, like I said before, just kind of the nature of the work, seeing a lot more of that kind of onlineify or captivate my PowerPoints kind of thing.
One of the things that I read early on while I was still full-time was busting the myth that freelancing means no boss. I actually read one perspective that maintained that really freelancing was going from one boss to multiple bosses. I've certainly found that to be true. And I'm wondering, what would you say were the differences in client relationships between your experience as a freelancer and your experience as a higher ed ID?
I'll start on the higher ed ID side is that having worked in different units and dealing with lots of different subject matter experts or course authors or sessional instructors or faculty, that there are a lot of underlying elements sitting in that kind of position that remain the same, like institutional policies are kind of the same. And so there are these things, a lot of assumptions you get to make about a project for any project that starts is that you already know a lot of your front end analysis is already done, like how long a course will be, how many times the students and the instructors kind of see each other is within a parameter. So there are a lot of assumptions you get to make, whereas on the freelancing side, talking to people from different organizations, different sets of expectations and different purposes of the instruction made it a little bit tougher to figure out in those early conversations. So that I think made a big difference in the client relationships, just because there wasn't necessarily all the shared language between you and an HR person or a program manager or whatever, whoever the contact point was. And then the other big thing I noticed was that in a full-time position within a university, work tends to come to you, and not just necessarily recurring clients, but because you're built into the system, then, you know, a new college or a new faculty or a new program kind of comes in and works with you. Whereas on the other side, and definitely what I noticed is the contract I was working on was coming to a close as, oh, I have to really be looking for other stuff and trying to manage how that's going to flow. And I know you talked about in a previous episode about that feast or famine thing. And so it's, yeah, like I can really see where the difference between those two styles of work are really at odds with each other.
Now, here we are, it's 2018, and you've decided that freelancing wasn't for you. And I'm sort of wondering, what happened? How did you decide, okay, JR, now is the time to get a full-time job again?
It actually happened a lot faster than that. I only bounced out of the institution for about 9 months. And that really came down to, I had left a full-time position to work on that particular project and try to get some other projects underway. And just because I was still pretty new to instructional design at that time, I think I had only finished about 2 years of instructional design work. And again, only in a higher ed setting. So there were all those kind of other skills that I didn't know I would need necessarily to branch out into freelancing. And when kind of faced with famine rather than a feast, then I found an opportunity to go back into the institution as a full-time employee. And I was still doing some volunteer work for instructional design as well. So that kind of gave me the extra flavor I think I was looking for, is something a little bit different with the knowledge that I don't have to chase down a whole bunch of other contracts.
Having left that full-time job to pursue the freelance opportunity, how was the process of getting back to full-time? Do you think you had an easier or a more difficult job finding that full-time position again?
Some of the things that really lent themselves to me being able to jump back in was an opportunity with an institution that I had worked with before. There was a little bit of that familiarity, but having to think about my portfolio and my resume and CV and how I approach those early conversations really changed in that time. I focused a lot on presentation and how to organize the information. Like I think my resume when I finished my bachelor degree was like 3 pages or something ridiculous. And I thought to myself, how can I make this one side of one sheet of paper? And so it took a lot of thinking and tooling to figure out how to do that. And I think that makes it stand out. And so then going back into an institution better equipped to start those early conversations or to put a good foot forward, I think overall has been really helpful.
What about sort of your work habits between your full-time and your freelancing? Like, you know, how did that go? Was there any sort of an adjustment either way?
There are kind of two main areas I think I saw the differences going back. One was kind of being at the same place at about the same time every day, and restricted possibilities to work remotely were a real adjustment. And that's something that I kind of took for granted maybe when doing contract work, was that, you know, I can schedule my day from 12 a.m. to 11:59 p.m. however I want, and what's going to work best for me and also for the project. Like I said, there was somebody across the ocean, so, you know, that changes meeting times and everything, and that flexibility was great. So it also then kind of ate away at some of the being able to compartmentalize life. So there's the drawback of the contract work, and the benefit of doing that kind of 9-to-5 thing is that I know I'm occupied from 9-to-5. And then it's like, then I go get to do the other things I'm interested in. And I'm the kind of person that keeps work email off of my phone and everything. So it's like, I do try and have a pretty clear divide there. The other thing that I really noticed, and I think that irritated me the most when I went back, was how many kind of distractions and things that interfered with my ability to focus. So working in like a common workspace, and so much as somebody walking past a window or past my desk without engaging with me would be enough to kind of distract me from what I was doing. And it felt like it was way less efficient. I noticed when going from full-time to the contract that it's like, oh, you know, I can get so much more done in about the same amount of time. And so I think that was the biggest adjustment going back, was just how to try and manage focus like that and not let people just constantly invade your space, whether they're trying to or not. It was pretty tough to get back into that.
Yeah. And yet at the same time, there's still not all that many remote opportunities.
That's something that I find is like the biggest, like maybe not the biggest myth, but this enormous myth of the remote worker. One example is actually a project and contract that I started the conversations on while I was freelancing. I was based in Alberta at the time, and the opportunity was in Ontario, which is across the country, like a 4-hour flight or something. You know, I got the call back and I was like, oh, great. Well, they saw my resume or my CV that I'm from Alberta. So this is a positive start because they already know I'm remote. And we got into the discussion finally about if I was to work with them for just a 6-month project, how that would work. So could I work remotely, or are they going to increase the salary or cover kind of like housing costs if I had to move there for 6 months? And they were not receptive to either of those ideas. In my opinion, that was a bit ridiculous that pay A wasn't as high just at the baseline as I might have requested, but that the expectation to move only for a 6-month contract really kind of made me pause on the idea that, like, oh yeah, not all organizations are into that idea of remote workers, and certainly not into just moving them in for 4 to 6 months. So that was definitely an eye-opener. It's all about context. So it's like, is there the flexibility that an organization will, you know, say with that 6-month contract, it's like, well, maybe I would just need to come in for a few weeks to really get that face-to-face time and build the relationship that way. But then ultimately it does go back to email. You know, we're just handing files back and forth. There's not necessarily a benefit to being in the same room at the same time trying to work on those materials.
You also mentioned that you're doing volunteer work and side projects. And I'm sort of wondering, is that something that you sort of took with you from your full-time job, or is that something that you sort of started to do as you were a freelancer? And how do you feel like that's helping you?
I think I first got into that idea of instructional design in the community while I was in grad school. One of the projects we worked on was with a local nonprofit. And it certainly was not traditional instructional design. I remember like having conversations with some of the students about like, how is this instructional design, and trying to take that broader view on like, well, what are the elements that are consistent here? And we have handoff documents, and we have to think about information architecture and client relationships and doing a needs assessment, and like the front end analysis was all there. And so that kind of broadened my perspective on like what it could be. And so then I was always open to kind of working with groups like that. And I was also fortunate at the time that I was in grad school that I was introduced to Jennifer Madrell from Designers for Learning. And just as I had taken on the contract for the OER project, Designers for Learning had a call go out for volunteers. And I just sat down and thought to myself, wow, like what a completely different kind of project and a great opportunity. I need to email Jen back right now. I think I've been volunteering with them for, we were just talking about it not that long ago. It's like two or three years now. Like there's been several versions of this course that have been offered now. And it's a MOOC, as you know, for adult basic education. It's an instructional design service course. So the whole methodology behind the course I thought was really captivating. And it was OER. So at the time I was like, yeah, right on. This is also like, this goes into the whole idea, different authoring platform. They struck up a relationship with OER Commons. So there are all of these really interesting and exciting pieces of that project. And being able to work with a team of instructional designers and subject matter experts was also something I hadn't had the opportunity for yet. So that volunteering opportunity really provided a different context for me to develop my approach to instructional design. And I brought in different kinds of like templates and approaches. And every instructional designer has their own templates and approaches. So it was really cool to see what other people were doing. So a little bit more involved than just working in an online community and kind of incidental conversations, but actually working on a project with these people was something that I continue to look for those kinds of opportunities. And it's been great working with Designers for Learning. So,
having been on both sides of this, do you feel like there was anything special that you've taken back into your full-time career from your time as a freelancer?
I think some of the templates and workflow, even if I had them before I started freelance, I think I revised and kind of honed them. Things like timeline management and communication, I definitely got better at. And I can't say that was necessarily the freelancing part or just more experience in instructional design, but also prototyping. I think I developed a little bit more where it's, I could just quickly try and whip something up and then say something like this and then go from there. And so I've carried that a bit more into what I'm doing now. There's one course I'm working with right now where he had a particular activity in mind. So I checked out a few different tools and then whipped up three prototypes. And I was like, based on what you've told me and the research I've done on this kind of activity, this, or this, like which represents what you were imagining the closest, and here are the benefits and drawbacks of each of these approaches. And so instead of going through and trying to hammer out an entire thing, is to say, it's like, well, here's something that kind of barely works, but, you know, is this kind of the right direction?
And that's so impactful, isn't it? I mean, like, letting somebody see something is just so, so, so impactful.
Yeah, the email I got back, I could kind of see he lit up like a Christmas tree and was just so excited about it. So it's really cool to be able to prototype something that quickly and say, it's like, well, something like this, and they react to it differently than an idea on paper.
Okay, so JR, I have three more questions for you as we wrap up the show. The first one is, what's your advice about how someone who's interested in freelancing should get started?
First, figure out why you're considering that path. For me, it was about variety of projects and trying something new. Second, work on your portfolio and resume. As I mentioned, I managed to crush a whole lot of information into one page, and most of that was throwing out stuff that didn't have to be there and tailoring it for each particular project or contract opportunity. And be clear with yourself about what concessions you're willing to make, about the nature of the work, and what your rate might be. So, you know, what are some things that you're willing to kind of offer or take a hit on, so to speak. And then at the very least, lurk in all of the online ID communities, follow people's blogs, you know, get involved in the LinkedIn communities. Even if you're not posting, just, you know, lurking is a way to get a good sense of what's going on.
Second question, what's your favorite thing about freelancing, and what's your favorite thing about being employed full time?
The freelancing had so much variety and flexibility. And so if you're the kind of person like me that likes to try a whole lot of different things, that's definitely a bonus. Full time, I think, can be what you make of it. So incidentally, I get a variety of content from disciplines because of working within a university. It can be natural sciences or political science or education or whatever it is. There's this whole dynamic range of content, even though the parameters of the design remain the same. You know, courses run from September to December, January to April kind of thing. Avoidance of that feast-famine cycle that can happen in freelance is the bottom level of Maslow's hierarchy of full-time work, and then you can kind of build on top of that.
Last but not least, where can people catch up with you?
I'm on Twitter at @JRDingwall. JRDingwall.ca is my kind of comprehensive portfolio site. Module13.ca is where I tend to post different kinds of prototypes or work that I'm doing, like pen turning, that kind of thing, and on LinkedIn.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me.